Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. If you were listening last week, you will have heard Conall Condren, Scientia Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of New South Wales, speculating on what the great 17th century English philosopher Thomas Hobbes might have had to say about the present situation in New Orleans. What happened, we suggested, is that the place descended into what Hobbes calls a state of nature. That's to say, a condition in which there is no sovereignty, nobody's in charge. And, as a consequence, nothing to protect the weak from the strong, the peaceful from the violent, those with property from those who want to steal it. In a famous passage of his book Leviathan, which I read last week, Hobbes describes what this condition is like. Hereby it is manifest that during the time men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and such a war as is of every man against every man. For war consisteth not in battle only, or the act of fighting, but in a tract of time wherein the will to contend by battle is sufficiently known. All other time is peace. In such condition there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and, which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. But what sort of a philosopher was it who arrived at this apparently grim view of human nature? After his death in 1679, his friend John Aubrey, the English pioneer of biography, wrote his brief life of Thomas Hobbes.
The day of his birth was April the 5th, Anno Domini, 1588. His mother fell in labour with him upon the fright of the invasion of the Spaniards. When he was a boy, he was placeman enough. But withal, he had even then a contemplative melancholiness. He would get him into a corner and learn his lesson by heart presently. His hair was black, and his schoolfellows were wont to call him Crow.
So he was born in 1588, the year that invasion from Spain threatened England. Perhaps we shouldn't make too much of that. Perhaps what really matters is that Hobbes would have grown up with a knowledge of the hideous wars of religion that were ravaging Europe. Interestingly, it can be argued that both Hobbes and his great French contemporary, the philosopher, mathematician and scientist René Descartes, were influenced by these horrible events. A few years ago, the philosopher Stephen Toulmin argued that the French wars of religion, Catholic against Protestant, Protestant against Catholic, had a profound effect on contemporary thinking. There was an attempt at compromise. The marriage in 1572 of the Protestant Henri of Navarre to the Catholic Marguerite de Valois. But a few days after the wedding, hundreds of Protestants visiting Paris for the occasion were slaughtered in the famous massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. Henri himself converted to Catholicism. Paris is worth a mass, he said, but he was assassinated in 1610. So, as Toulmin puts it, by 1620, people in positions of power no longer saw pluralism as an option. Living with uncertainty had not, in their view, put an end to religious strife, but rather was the cause of it. Theoretical inquiry became less concrete as philosophers tried to find truths that were abstract and universal, something everybody could acknowledge as true. Both Descartes and Hobbes, who crossed philosophical swords, were concerned with finding a way of ensuring peace. Back to Aubrey's life of Hobbes.
He was 40 years old before he looked on geometry, which happened accidentally. Being in a gentleman's library, Euclid's Elements lay open. He read a proposition. By G, said he. He would now and then swear an emphatical oath by way of emphasis. This is impossible. So he reads the demonstration of it. which referred him back to such a proposition, which proposition he read. That referred him back to another, which he also read. That, at last, he was demonstratively convinced of that truth. This made him in love with geometry. I have heard Mr. Hobbes say that he was wont to draw lines on his thigh, and on the sheets abed, and also multiply and divide.
You see what's going on here. Hobbes was impressed by the work of the classical Greek geometer Euclid because it seemed to present us with a whole structure of unchallengeably true knowledge, developed step by logical step from a few basic definitions and axioms. If only political life were like that. But perhaps it is. Perhaps we can begin with a few basic facts about human nature, that we fear death and seek to prolong our lives as far as we can, and achieve peaceful society under the governance of a strong sovereign. Here's more of my conversation with Conall Condren, together with a few additional remarks from Hobbes's 17th century biographer, John Aubrey. Hobbes, I think, said that he was born prematurely because his mother was frightened by the coming of the Spanish Armada. Fear is a major factor in his view of the world, isn't it?
Yes. The story is almost certainly totally fanciful. He was born in the middle of Wiltshire, a long way from anything but a small barge. But yes, his birth probably was premature. And that's a fanciful way of stressing how important fear is for him as an explanatory category. And he made a great fuss about it himself. He often claimed that he was somebody who was quite fearful and was the first person to run away from England when the civil wars broke out and so forth. And also was very keen to come back just as soon as, you know, there was a degree of security which Paris didn't afford him anymore. So yes, fear does an awful lot, because it's because of what we fear that causes us to make actions that are, I suppose, anticipatory of danger, and therefore we can preempt and make situations worse by a forward defence, as it were.
As I said, Leviathan was published in 1651. The English Civil War had broken out in 1642. Mm-hmm. King Charles I was, as I would say, murdered, and as Geoffrey Robertson would say, executed in 1649. It had been a time of violent upheaval in England. Did this, do you think, affect his political thoughts?
It did to some extent. It should be remembered that the rudiments of his political theories were developed before the wars worked out. And a number of people have argued that the really important formative political experiences of his lifetime were really the French Wars of Religion. And it's now being argued by an increasing number of historians that, in fact, the English Civil Wars were the last of the Wars of Religion. So what I think was the case for Hobbes was that the English experience, which he sort of anticipated, did accentuate and colour his beliefs. The passage that you read from Leviathan is written, obviously, after the end of the wars and with one eye on the wars, and it's much more lurid and colourful than his earlier descriptions of a state of nature, which are much more schematic. So it definitely had an impact, yes.
When the Parliament sat that began in April 1640 and was dissolved in May following, and in which many points of the regal power, which were necessary for the peace of the kingdom and safety of His Majesty's person, were disputed and denied, Mr. Hobbes wrote a little treatise in English, wherein he did set forth and demonstrate that the said powers and rights were inseparably annexed to the sovereignty, which sovereignty they did not then deny to be in the king, but it seems understood not, or would not understand, that inseparability. Of this treatise, though not printed, many gentlemen had copies, which occasioned much talk of the author, and had not His Majesty dissolved the Parliament, it had brought him in danger of his life. Then thought Mr. Hobbes, 'tis time now for me to shift for myself, and so withdrew into France and resided at Paris. This little manuscript treatise grew to be his book, De Cive, and at last grew there to be the so formidable Leviathan. The manner of writing of which book, he told me, was thus. He said that he sometimes would set his thoughts upon researching and contemplating, always with this rule, that he very much and deeply considered one thing at a time. He walked much and contemplated, and he had in the head of his staff a pen and ink horn, carried always a notebook in his pocket, and as soon as the notion darted, he presently entered it into his book, or else he should perhaps have lost it. He had drawn the design of the book into chapters, etc., so he knew whereabout it would come. Thus that book was made.
So you can't divide, you can't share out power. Power needs to reside in some one place, in some one authority.
Yes, Hobbes was an absolutist in the 16th and 17th century sense of that term, inasmuch as there must be one single locus for law and law enforcement. It was a very idealised vision of government, given that you were living in a world that didn't have even police forces. So everybody had to do a bit of their own law enforcement. But this was explicitly against theories around, again, at the time, that authority should in some way be divided for safety's sake. These theories he called rather dismissively mixarchy, which is simply a step on the way to anarchy. And it's always dangerous to double guess what Hobbes would have said, because he's deliberately perplexing and paradoxical. But I think he would have called the United States of America a mixarchy and would expect the sort of chaos to come from a natural disaster that has come, because it's so much easier for people to engage in extreme violence if they're all armed.
So for him, the work of civilization, the work of keeping things going, it is work. We can't ever take it for granted.
We can't take it for granted, and it's important both that subjects and sovereigns realise this. The problem for the sovereign, and he's reluctant to try and tell sovereigns what to do, they're the bosses after all, is that if they rely too much on force, then they will make the situation worse, because according to Hobbes's theoretical schema, people come into society for protection and a degree of security. If they are going to be threatened by overwhelming force, then it's completely counterproductive. So they have to work and persuade people, and people have to learn really how important it is, or accept the suasives of the sovereign, to live in peace.
Did he have a notion of sovereignty failing? One of the things that seems to me to have gone wrong in Louisiana is that, if you like, the sovereign authorities, certainly the municipal government and the state government, were just failing. They were simply losing it. Did he have a notion of what you do when you've got a bad sovereign?
You put up with a bad sovereign. If you've got a non-existent sovereign, well, you have a non-existent sovereign and you start all over again. But a bad sovereign is something you just have to put up with. This is why he's so insistent. There are only two conditions. There is peace and there is war. And he's really trying to persuade you that peace is, no matter how uncomfortable it might be, no rotten your government, it is far superior to anything else. So it's a question of hanging on to nurse for fear of finding anything worse. And it doesn't matter how bad the nurse is. The one point at which you cannot put up with it is when, of course, you are directly threatened by the sovereign, and that puts you back into a state of nature, irrespective of what's happening to everybody else. So you have a right to defend yourself, even when you're condemned to die on the gallows. That right always remains with you.
Thomas Hobbes said that if it were not for the gallows, some men are of so cruel a nature as to take a delight in killing men more than I should to kill a bird.
Brian Cox, reading from John Aubrey's Life of Mr. Thomas Hobbes of Malmesbury. And you also heard Professor Conal Condren. I'm Alan Saunders. I'll be back next week with more philosophy. Stay with Radio National now for Occam's Razor, presented by Robin Williams.